From KCRW, this is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis with a show that connects you to the people and places and peanuts and pizza of Southern California. The Dodgers begin their playoff journey this Saturday, once again as baseball's Western Division champs. If you're one of the lucky folks who got a ticket to the game this weekend or one of the games, you might hear the booming voice of Robert Sanchez, a.k.a. Peanut Man.
Same pizza here, pizza. Same pepperoni pizza right here.
We visited with Peanut Man before, but now we're really going to get to know him. He's been scrambling up and down the stairs of Chavez Ravine for the last 50 years. He's made a name for himself selling peanuts and cotton candy, beer, you name it, and Peanut Man has sold it. He's even become a bit of a local celebrity.
My Instagram account has really taken off as the Peanut Man. I have over 13,000 followers now.
Robert's wife, Terry, says he gets recognized all over town.
Everybody recognizes him at the grocery store, at the casino, at a restaurant, everywhere.
Well, these days, Robert spends almost as much time taking photos with fans as he does running up and down the stands, slinging pizzas. Reporter David Weinberg caught up with Peanut Man, and he brings us this story.
As a young kid growing up in Lincoln Heights, Robert Sanchez was obsessed with bowling.
I went to Lincoln High School, Cypress Park area. I was a bowler. There was a bowling alley there.
After school, Robert would hit up his mom for bowling money. But one day, the well went dry.
Because she got tired of giving me money for bowling. I was a bowling fanatic. She said, you got to go get a job. I asked my buddy, do you have a job? He goes, yeah, where do you work? Right up there. Where? Dodger Stadium. So I went up there. The boss says, hey, put a clean shirt, tie, comb your hair. And I started walking the stairs.
The first time Robert Sanchez walked into Dodger Stadium, it was 1974. He was 16 years old, and he'd never been to a game before. He was there to work.
It was wild. It's crazy. It's big. Wow. The big capital W-O-W. Wow. And to this day, it's still wow. It's a beautiful stadium.
Robert learned that there's a hierarchy among stadium vendors. The ones who've been there the longest get to pick what section they work and what product they sell. As a newcomer,
I was selling at the low end of the stick. If anybody remembers the word tab, the soda tab, and I outsold the Coca-Cola guys and everybody else with the, I'm going to say the word, the shittest item, but I outsold everybody and they called me hustler.
Robert went back for another season, then another, but it was a part-time job. And he didn't make enough money to support a family. So he learned a trade, carpentry.
I was independent. I hired a few people. Then I went to Dodger games at night. I made it happen. I was hustling.
Robert eventually got a full-time job as a carpenter for the Los Angeles Unified School District.
If a junior high kid hangs on a restroom stall door and breaks it, well, we get the call. And we run out there like Minutemen. Go fix it. Wooden floors. They do buckle. It gets interesting.
One day, Robert got called out to a job that changed his life. A door to a kindergarten classroom was broken. It was March 1994.
I was a teacher there, and he walked in to fix my door. And that's how we met. And the door, there was nothing wrong with it, he said, but it was. And he said, oh, liar, liar, pants on fire. And he caught me with that phrase. He made me laugh.
This is Terry Sanchez. Robert kept finding reasons to come back to her room.
We were both divorced at the time, so we're both out the gate.
And then we started going out, and we had a lot in common. And he's always been a family man, and that's what really caught my attention. He had the two boys and my daughter, and they're almost about the same ages.
And 2 years later, we got married. I says, what are we waiting for? What the hell?
Robert and Terry have been together for 29 years.
I'm a lucky guy. It's a great tag team, and I couldn't do it without her.
Terry loves that Robert works at the stadium.
Do you miss him when he's gone?
No, I don't. So it's my little breakaway from him. He's a little bit loud sometimes.
I was going to ask, has he always been this loud?
He's always been loud. People say, is he hard of hearing? I go, no, that's just the way he is. You know, does he you know, have some kind of vocal problem? I go, no, he just likes to be loud. That's it.
Who's hungry?
It's so funny. You got
not yet. Not yet.
Sooner or later, you got to eat. Here we go. Here we go.
Robert eventually worked his way up to selling the holy grail of stadium food, the peanut.
Peanuts was the number one seller, hands down. Everybody wanted peanuts. Back then, I was selling a ton of peanuts. Nobody came close.
Robert loved the job. He fed off the energy of the crowd and made a name for himself as one of the more exuberant vendors.
Some guys started saying, "Peanut Man, Peanut Man." All of a sudden, 80 people are chanting, "Peanut Man," as I'm waving, and everyone is having a good time with it.
Robert embraced the name Peanut Man. He got a vanity license plate, P-N-U-T-M-A-N. He also developed his own catchphrase.
What the hell, right? It's just a slogan I said and kind of stuck. And everybody says it to me, "Peanut Man, so what the hell? So what the hell, man?"
On a recent Thursday night, the Dodgers were playing the Milwaukee Brewers. Robert was working the bleachers. As an old-timer, he gets to choose where he works. And typically, he picks the field level and the bleachers. And even though he still goes by the name Peanut Man, Robert is now a pizza man. These days, that's where the money is.
You follow the money. We make a percentage, and pizza is almost $18. Pizza's the bomb. Everybody eats pizza. And the pizza, you can share. You got kids, you can shut two kids up at one time. Here you go, guys, you know.
Robert carries an insulated bag with about a dozen pepperoni pizzas. And once it's empty, he races back to get more. Robert has a name for the money he makes at the stadium, bonus bucks.
It took us a lot of cruises. We went to the Caribbean, we went to Panama, we went to Alaska, all the other ones in between, Vegas every other month, you know, the casinos around here. You know, we like to gamble.
There have been a lot of highlights in Peanut Man's career, like the time he tried to catch a home run and injured his hand.
When Corey Seager hit his first home run.
And the pitch. Swung on. Fly ball to center. And
I hear the crack of the bat. I looked up, and about 10 feet above my head was the ball coming. I put my hand up. It hit my hand. I missed the ball. I wasn't ready for it. My hand was purple, blue, green for 2 weeks.
There are hazards lurking at every corner. Things like errant hot dogs.
I've stepped on a hot dog that slides from under you, and I've slipped on nacho cheese. It happens. You're going to take your hits.
And there is, of course, the occasional knucklehead.
There's always knuckleheads is what I'm saying. In any sport, you're going to have knuckleheads.
Yeah, how did you deal with that kind of stuff when you first started out?
It's got to go in one ear and out the other because we're out there alone. You're a loner. You get 2-3 people that say you were being disrespectful or anything negative, you will lose your job in a heartbeat. You know, it's not a perfect world out there.
As one of the more seasoned vendors at the stadium, Robert has mastered the art of what he calls sticking and moving.
They're paying me to exercise up there. I'm averaging 15,000 steps a game, 6 miles a game. So as time moves on, I'm still there.
This season is Robert's 50th year working at the stadium. He's 65 years old, and he's retired from carpentry, but he plans to keep working at the stadium. He says he's good for at least another 10 years.
Hey, pizza here, pizza. With your name on it, baby! Woo!
For KCRW, I'm David Weinberg.
Pepperoni pizza! Pepperoni pizza right here! Who's hungry?
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For a lot of folks, the world feels like a lot right now. Everything is expensive. Adjusting to post-pandemic life is tough, work is exhausting, and finding time to practice healthy habits on top of it all, well, who has the energy for that? Have you ever wished someone could just show you how to live life the right way? Well, a lot of life coaches claim they can do just that, and nowadays these so-called gurus and mentors are not hard to find, especially here in wellness-obsessed L.A. But are they legit? L.A.-based journalist Jane Marie was equal parts curious and skeptical about the life coaching industry when she decided to try it out for herself, and she catalogs it all in the new season of her podcast, The Dream. Jane Marie, welcome to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
This is the third season of the podcast, which in the past has explored other facets of the self-improvement industry. It's a huge industry, including multi-level marketing schemes, and I know wellness culture as well. This season, though, has some similar themes. It's also really different because it gets a lot more personal. Why'd you choose that way of putting yourself out there?
It felt like the natural progression from the show, honestly. Looking at the girl boss culture of multi-level marketing, you know, LuLaRoe and all of these, you know, be your own boss at home and be a mom anytime you want and have it all. But life coaching felt like the natural next step. Broader in a way, because it's really just about what is our deal here in America with, you know, wanting to optimize ourselves and our days and leaning in and, you know, having the right mindset and being productive. It's exhausting, especially after the last few years we've had. Just like everybody else, I came out of the pandemic fairly depressed. My life didn't look anything like it had a couple of years ago. And I thought, I'm going to try to find somebody who can tell me how to do this differently.
And did you find somebody?
I did. And I'm shocked. I'm the most surprised that I did, because I spend an entire episode basically shopping around on Yelp for a life coach in LA and just making fun of everyone. Because they do kind of lean woo-woo, which is not my flavor.
These folks they're not fitness coaches and they're not health professionals, right?
Well, sometimes.
Really? Can they be therapists as well?
Yeah, I've spoken to a number of therapists who have quit their licensed therapy practices to become life coaches.
So, I mean, do they have like a whiteboard and like grids? Or, I mean, I'm trying to, you know, it's like, how do they, because they have to specialize and really get to know you to understand what it is you need.
Right. Well, I think that you picking the life coach you want to start talking to is the first level of weeding people out, right? So in my noodling around, I saw there was a lot of life coaches who are into microdosing. There were many life coaches who start from, you know, prosperity mindset thinking, like trying to get rich, basically, like business coaches and finance coaches. Then there's relationship coaches, parenting life coaches, just it is endless. And what I ended up going with was, funnily enough, a wellness coach.
Okay.
After I spent a whole season railing on the industry. But she just, I don't know, things clicked. And then when she first came into the office, she did an intake, like sat down with me and said, "What's your problem?" And I said, I want someone to tell me what to do with my feet every day. You know, like, where am I? What time do I need to do stuff? Where am I going? I feel so unmoored at the moment. And I just need someone to like help me put edges on my day, you know?
And you did this on your podcast. You did this with a microphone.
I did. Yeah.
I mean, that is a certain amount of vulnerability, right?
Well, I think I would do it by accident anyway. So making the choice at the beginning of the season was good, because I don't have to be like, whoops, I talked about my breakup. I mean, episode 2, I'm crying like crazy about my breakup. Also, it would be strange to report on this and then try to hide certain parts of the experience. I mean, the very first thing I think you hear from me and my life coach is me working out, which I do not do. I do it now, but before I met her, I don't like sweating. I like to sit down.
If you have and show so much vulnerability to this woman whom you chose on Yelp or on the internet, and you know, you're putting yourself really out there, then how do you, especially with that vulnerability, look at it skeptically?
I tell her to her face.
You do?
Yeah, on the show too, I told her, at first she really scared me. There was something culty about it, about her, about what we were doing. She's very woo-woo. She does like full moon fasting and believes that your uterus is like important to your soul and stuff, which I just don't. And I got a little freaked out in the beginning. So I just told her and we talked about it. And then we just developed a real friendship through that, which I think is how I make all my friends, right? Being just honest with people.
Well, again, I mean, that's putting yourself out there. And mm-hmm. and I guess this is about what you learned mm-hmm. about the history and the culture, too, of yeah. life coaching, right? Through your own investigation, through your own, like, search.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think what was nice about my coach is she didn't say there's one way to do things. I think that some of the more dangerous types of coaches are more adamant that there's a formula, there's one way of doing things. Like, you have to remove these words from your vocabulary and these people from your life, and, you know, that there's a right way of living. That's where I think people can kind of get into trouble and it starts to veer into cult territory.
And there's a lot of money in it, too, right?
Oh, God. So much money.
Yeah. Especially here in L.A., I would imagine.
I spoke to a woman who pays $30,000 an hour for her life coach.
$30,000 an hour?
An hour. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, for some people, they make a lot of money. And you don't have to get certified. You don't have to do any specific training. So it's really hard to tell if you're getting your money's worth, sort of. Again, there's no licensing board. There's no oversight of it. It's just, I can call myself a life coach tomorrow.
Jane, does it feel scammy? I mean, I don't want to, I'm not trying to throw anybody under the bus, but it's like, if so much money is going into this, I mean, I'm sure there are good intentioned, well-intentioned people, right, who want to help you and maybe charge you a fair price.
In all scams, there are. In all scams, there are people who have good intentions or have convinced themselves that the way they're doing it is different. But I do think it's kind of scammy. You know, I've seen evidence that, like, people adjust their prices based on whether they want to go on a vacation that month. It's easy. It's an easy place to scam people.
Not giving anything away. What is your takeaway? If there's, like, a thesis sentence you can give us about what it is you got from all of this.
Maximizing your potential, believing we live in a meritocracy, prosperity thinking, all of it's a scam is what I came away from this thinking. It was, you know, these are tools railroad barons and oil barons made up to make themselves richer, is convince the populace that just work a little bit harder, just a little bit harder, just a little bit harder. Oh, you're not, you know why you're not working hard enough? It's because you don't think about it the right way. You're not using the right mindset. And in the end, like, we're all so stressed out and there is no way to get rich. They are hoarding all the money.
All right. Jane Marie, host of the Dream Podcast. You can find a link to listen to the latest season about life coaching and the industry at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Jane, thanks.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Even more now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Chances are, if you're not a part of the gay community, you don't know much about a man named Tuukko Laaksonen. Or maybe you've seen his work, a lot of it being not safe for work. He was an artist who went by the pseudonym Tom, as in Tom of Finland, often using erotic themes of muscular gay men in suggestive positions. There are usually motorcycles and leather clothing and harnesses involved, or no clothing at all. This coming weekend, the Tom of Finland Foundation is hosting an art and culture festival in downtown's Arts District. It'll feature visual art, artist conversations, even a live drawing session, all with a nod to Tom. Richard Villani is creative director at the Tom of Finland Foundation and is here with more about what's happening this weekend. Hey, Richard.
Hey there. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Tell us more about Tuukko Laaksonen, a.k.a. Tom of Finland.
Tom was an artist, you know, but for a good part of Tom's life, he was actually an art director at McCann Erickson in Finland, and his drawings he did on the side. And only after about 25 years, when he felt his artwork was sustainable, that he was actually selling his art, that he was able to step away from his full-time job and live off of his artwork.
I mean, he's an extraordinary artist.
Yes.
Died in, what, 1991? He was 71, I believe. He was born in 1920.
Yes.
So he lived
much of the 20th century, and I'm sure growing up in Finland and Scandinavia, being gay was probably frowned upon, and he was very shy about putting that kind of work and art out.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think it wasn't just frowned upon. It was illegal. Homosexuality was illegal. So you kind of had that staring you in the face. And
did he say that his art was an outlet for that?
It was an outlet in the sense of trying to create, I guess, maybe his own utopia of what he could not find or did not see. For Tom, the war years were the years where he felt like he came to life as a gay man. You know, he talked about having sex with his fellow soldiers, and I think that's a lot of where the imagery of men in uniform came to play, was his time serving in the army. And, you know, you can obviously see it in his work, but it's something he spoke about as well.
There's actually a Tom of Finland house here in L.A., right? How did that come to be?
So the house is Dirk Dehner, and Dirk is the president and co-founder of Tom of Finland Foundation. Dirk founded the foundation with Tom as Tom's was getting to a place in his life where he wasn't really sure what he wanted to do with his artwork. They decided to form the foundation, but the house itself actually, you know, Dirk bought the house with his partner, his ex-partner, and his ex-partner's new partner. They bought it, I believe, in 1978. And then the AIDS crisis happened, and one by one, each one of those men passed away except for Dirk. Mm. So Dirk took on the ownership of the home. When Dirk and Tom became acquainted with each other, they became actually pen pals first. Dirk said, you know, if you ever come to California, please let me host you. And eventually, you know, a couple of years later, Tom was coming to Los Angeles and Dirk began hosting him. And then I believe it was for the next 10 years, up until Tom couldn't travel any longer because of his emphysema, Tom would spend about 6 months a year in Los Angeles and 6 months a year in Finland with his partner, Velle.
You think there, Richard, are there any misconceptions that you get about Tom and his work, his artwork?
I kind of personally hate the word pornography or porn associated with Tom's work, because I think Tom was a fine artist. And I think when you look at some of his masterpieces and you actually see, you look at the detail of the work, it's quite mind-blowing to see each kind of stroke of the graphite pencil on the vellum paper. Working at the foundation, it's a really beautiful experience of having Tom's work around us. But there's also, Tom a lot of times did his work through preliminary stages. So he kind of start with a rough drawing and work his way to the final image. And for me, some of those preliminary drawings are incredibly powerful, because it's, you can see an artist trying to find their way of to create the perfect image. However, I will quote something Tom has said, which was that if he was not aroused by the work he was doing, he knew it was not going to be a good drawing.
You were in London and Berlin, but in LA, the show is in a decidedly LA location at the Soho House in downtown LA. What are you going to see when you go there?
You're going to see a lot of brilliant art. You're going to meet a lot of incredibly talented artists.
Who are some of the artists that you think you should see?
Off the top of my head, there's Felix Dion and Jonathan, who are two of our artists in residence. Obviously, Rick Castro, who's been a part of the foundation for years, Ruben Esparza, Miguel Reyes. I don't know. It's hard to say who should you watch out to. You should check everyone out, because everyone's work is different. There's photography, there's painting, there's ceramics, there's pencil on paper.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a great time. Richard Villani, creative director over at the Tom of Finland Foundation. Thanks so much for coming on and talking with us. We appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thank you, Steve.
And by the way, if you'd like to see some of the work that's going to be featured this weekend, some of the work that Richard mentioned, you can check out our website at kcrw.com/GLA. Well, that's all the time we have for this evening. Whew, what a show. Tomorrow on this program, a recent march here in L.A. illustrates a newly supportive relationship between housing advocates and unions and union membership in California, as in you need a living wage to be able to live somewhere. And the new Made in L.A. exhibit going on at the Hammer, we get a preview as well tomorrow right here on Greater LA. Check us out anytime online at kcrw.com/GLA. While you're at the website, tell us how you're doing. Share with us a story idea you might have. Maybe even grab the podcast, too, so you can take us on the go. kcrw.com/GLA. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Celine Mendiola, Ted Robbins, Phil Richards, Sue Margulies, Ray Guarna, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Mike Vogel, Evan Ray, and Christian Bordahl all helped run the episode this evening. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for the time. Thanks for that ear. Have a great night.